Mr. President, the chief of security, came up to him and said, "We've uncovered a coup attempt or coup plot that is going on. We know where the rebels are. And I suggest that you give the orders to act now. If you don't, your life and our government is in danger of falling apart." The president looked at him and said, "So, what shall I do? What shall I do?" Switching gears, I'm going to start in Luke chapter 19. This is Palm Sunday. The triumphant entry. Tomorrow is Palm Sunday. You know, followed a week later by Easter. This whole section from Luke chapter 19, verse 28, all the way into chapter 20, verse 19 is actually, or should be considered as a single unit. The triumphal entry is followed by Jesus weeping over Jerusalem as he looks over the city, as he looks at the temple. The following day, Jesus goes to the temple and the second cleansing of the temple takes place. And then following that, the authorities are upset and Jesus is challenged as to where his authority comes. And then Jesus tells a story, a parable. Why do I think this whole section is a single unit that we need to kind of look at all together? Well, I believe that's the case because of the frequency of the term stones that's used in this section. Luke uses stones to tie all of these sections together. And in fact, the parable of the wicked tenants, the wicked vine dressers, the evil farmers, the corrupt farmhands, is a summary of all of it. And so, let's begin in chapter 19, verse 28. And Jesus tells, or asks a few of his disciples to go into Jerusalem to find a donkey for him to ride on. And so the disciples go. They find a donkey, and as they're beginning to untie it, the owner asks the disciples, "Oh, wait a minute. What are you doing? Now, why are you untying this donkey?" And the disciples answer, "The Lord needs it." And just as Jesus had predicted, they were allowed to take the donkey back to Jesus. And so Jesus gets on the donkey and begins his entry into Jerusalem. And as this entourage begins to enter in, they lay down their cloaks, they cut down palm branches, and lay it down for Jesus on top of the donkey to ride over. And as they're going through, the people begin to exclaim, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. peace in heaven and glory in the highest. This blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. This is a reference back to Psalm 118. And what we will notice as we go on is that Luke makes frequent references to Psalm 118 within this story unit from Luke 19:28 into chapter 20, verse 19. Once again, indicating that this is a single unit that's to be considered together. And so as the people, as the disciples, gather together to escort Jesus into Jerusalem, they're exclaiming, now blessed, Hosanna is what it means. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Save us, Hosanna. And as usual, a number of the authorities are not too happy with what is going on. After all, even though no one is claiming Jesus to be a political king, they are certainly claiming him to be a king. And that's the last thing the authorities want. Well, they have a good, well, they have at least a working relationship with the Romans, if not good. And they certainly don't want to upset the apple cart. And so they come up to Jesus and they say, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. And Jesus answers them and says, I tell you, if these were silent, if the disciples were silent, if the people were silent, the very stones would cry out. And as they're coming down, approaching the city, Jesus begins to weep. You know, saying, would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation. So once again, Jesus mentions stones. Now Luke doesn't have a break between this and the next incident, but in the other synoptics, it's apparent that after this, after Jesus enters the city through the gates, well, the gates is another motif in reference to Psalm 118, he goes to the temple, takes a look around, and then returns to Bethany, where he spends the night. The following day, he returns to the temple, and he drives out those who sold, saying to them, It is written, My house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. And according to some commentators, Jesus then had his disciples basically take control of the entire temple courtyard for a period of a number of hours, preventing anyone from using the courtyard as a thoroughfare, preventing anyone from buying or selling within the courtyard. And naturally, you know, that disrupted quite a bit of what the religious leaders, mainly the Sadducees, were trying to accomplish there. Well, that was to make money. Middle Easterners take their sacred sites very seriously. And to have someone come in and challenge their authority was unheard of. Now, Annas, that was the godfather of the priestly clan. Caiaphas was the high priest at the time, at this time, but Annas, Caiaphas' father-in-law, you might, in today's term, call him, you know, the godfather of the mafia. And so here was this one man, Jesus, and his band of disciples, who had popular power, challenging the entire establishment of Annas. And the result was he wasn't happy. And there was that was yet another common ground with which to, with the Pharisees, with which to seek to destroy Jesus. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the saying goes. Pharisees and Sadducees normally didn't get along. But in Jesus, they had a common enemy. Jesus was challenging the laws of the Pharisees, and Jesus was challenging the religion of the Sadducees. And so in this common enemy, the Pharisees and the Sadducees came together. But because of the popularity of Jesus, they weren't willing to take him out in the open, because that could possibly incite a riot and bring the Romans down upon them, and that was the last thing they wanted to do. So the first thing they wanted to do was to try to discredit Jesus. Because they thought if they could discredit Jesus, then perhaps his popularity would wane and they could take care of him after that. And so one day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes would be the from the party of the Pharisees, with their elders came up and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority do you do these things? Or who is it that gave you this authority?" He answered them, "I also will ask you a question. Now tell me, was the baptism of John from heaven or from man?" And they discussed it with one another, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, why did you not believe him? But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Jesus may not give a direct answer, but he will tell a story. And that's where the parable comes in. And so Jesus, he began to tell the people this parable. "A man planted a vineyard and let it out to tenants and went into another country for a long time. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but they also beat and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. And he said, he sent yet a third. This one also. And not only did they beat, shame, send him away empty-handed. No, they wounded and didn't simply send away, but they cast out, they forcefully cast him out of the vineyard. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Let us kill him, so that the inheritance may be ours." And they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, when the people and the leaders heard this, they said, "Surely not." But he looked directly at them and said, "What then is this that is written? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." Here Jesus is quoting again from Psalm 118. And Jesus continues, "Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him." And this would be kind of an allusion or reference back to Isaiah chapter 8. And also to Daniel chapter 2. The stone. Now in this parable, where is the conclusion? Where is the climax? In our typical Western Greek-oriented thought, linear thought, we frequently have understood the conclusion to be, you know, he will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. We take this often to be a story of judgment. But is that really where, was that really Jesus' point? And the answer is probably not. Because in Hebrew, Middle Eastern thinking and logic, what we frequently find is what is called ring composition or chiastic composition, where the climax and the point of the story is found in the middle of the story. And so where is the middle? The middle of the story is found where the man, the owner of the vineyard, asks, "What shall I do?" See, he just sent out 3 servants. They all came back empty-handed. Each servant getting progressively worse treatment from the tenants. The vineyard owner has every right to call up an army to seek the authorities to force the tenants to render to him what is due to him, and to punish the tenants for the mistreatment of his servants. And in fact, the listeners of the story, as they were listening to Jesus tell it, at this point, would have expected that when Jesus asked the question, speaking for the owner, "What shall I do?" You see, this whole story is an allusion back to Isaiah chapter 5. The first part of Isaiah chapter 5, which begins, find that, "Let me sing a song for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes." And now, when inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its head, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. The listeners of Jesus' parable up to this point would have been thinking probably back to what I just read in Isaiah 5 of this vineyard that God had planted which did not yield fruit. Now there are certain differences in the way Jesus tells the story. Isaiah doesn't have tenant farmers. In Jesus' story there are tenant farmers. In Isaiah's little parable there, the vineyard is destroyed. And so the listeners of Jesus' story would have expected something similar, a judgment to fall upon the tenants and on the vineyard, swift, merciless. What they wouldn't have expected is what Jesus then proceeded to say. I will send my beloved Son. Perhaps they will respect him. The owner is going to send his son, unguarded, unaccompanied, unescorted, to try to reason things out with the tenant farmers, with the tenants. The owner has every right to be angry. Yet instead of acting upon that right, acting upon anger in an expected manner, he responds in grace. He responds basically offering an olive branch, offering forgiveness, if they will simply respect him. What he's saying here is, as the son goes to meet with the tenants, he's basically saying, "No, I know what you did to the previous servants that my father sent. But here, if you will just act and behave and treat me and my father with respect, all of that past will be forgotten. All of that past will be forgiven." And that's what the father wants. That's what the owner of the vineyard wants. But unfortunately, in Jesus' parable, that is not what happens, because when the tenants see him, see the son, they say, "This is the heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours." Now, what is this inheritance? In that time, there was a practice where if a person could squat the land for 3 full years, it became theirs. And so perhaps this is what it is alluding to, because the first servant is sent, the second servant is sent, the third servant is sent. So you possibly have the idea of 3 years there, and then the son. To the leaders, to the shepherds of Israel, to the tenants, the inheritance was simply land and power, earthly power, earthly land. But to Jesus, he was thinking of a completely different thing when he talked about inheritance. And so, you know, by killing the Son, both in the parable and in reality, as the leaders were seeking to destroy Jesus, they thought that by destroying the Son, they would retain their claims on the land. They would retain their claims on authority. And what Jesus then proceeds to tell them is that, you know, what you're going to do by destroying me is you're going to destroy yourselves, because the inheritance that I want to give you is not the kind of inheritance that you're seeking. As long as you continue to seek the kind of inheritance that you want, earthly, material inheritance, you're going to come against me. And whenever you do that, there is the result is inevitable. That result is destruction. And that's what Jesus is saying when he quotes from the Old Testament, from Isaiah and Psalms. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. The people listening, both the common people, as well as the leaders, understood perfectly well what Jesus was saying. Now, this parable was no secret. And so, in verse 19, the scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them, but they feared the people. This parable is primarily then not a story about judgment, but about the grace and about the mercy and about the forgiveness that God offers even to those that would mistreat him and his representatives. You know, he's saying that it's not too late. Accept my offer. Turn back. Accept my offer. And this result of being crushed and broken doesn't have to happen. Now, certainly, there is judgment. But it's a warning of what will happen if they continue in the path that they've gone. Kenneth Bailey records a story here. Apparently true, verified by American intelligence, who was serving in Jordan at the time the incident took place. One night in the early 1980s, the king was informed by his security police that a group of about 75 Jordanian army officers were at that very moment meeting in a nearby barracks, plotting a military overthrow of the kingdom. The security officers requested permission to surround the barracks and arrest the plotters. After a somber pause, the king refused and said, "Bring me a small helicopter." A helicopter was brought. The king climbed in with the pilot and himself flew to the barracks and landed on its flat roof. The king told the pilot, "If you hear gunshots, fly away at once without me." Unarmed, the king then walked down two flights of stairs and suddenly appeared in the room where the plotters were meeting and quietly said to them, "Gentlemen, It has come to my attention that you are meeting here tonight to finalize your plans to overthrow the government, take over the country, and install a military dictator. If you do this, the army will break apart and the country will be plunged into civil war. Tens of thousands of innocent people will die. There is no need for this. Here I am. Kill me and proceed. That way, only one man will die. After a moment of stunned silence, the rebels as one rushed forward to kiss the king's hand and feet and place loyalty to him for life. Similar story. Different result, perhaps. Yet, in the end, even though Jesus did not win over the rebels, he did in fact win the world. Because all of us are in fact born in rebellion against God. And so this parable, even though it was told with the religious leaders primarily in mind, we can place each one of us can place ourselves in this parable of the vineyard. And Jesus, the Father, asks, what shall I do to win back the rebels? He says, I know. I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him. What is your response? What is my response? What is our response when we see Jesus come towards us? Will we turn around and run? Or perhaps, no, we'll take a weapon. Or if we don't have one, we'll take a fist and beat him. Or perhaps, as the Father and as Jesus desires, we will run to him, fall at his feet, kiss his hands. What is our response?